this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss efforts to support federal police officers with AFGE Local 1401 Assistant Chief Steward Brian Frayer, Public Service Recognition Week with Partnership for Public Service Vice President Laura Shane, and the need to provide protective equipment to federal correctional officers with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry. We've been joined by Brian Frayer, AFGE Assistant Chief Steward of Local 1401. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks, Jason. I appreciate you having us back on.
You've been fighting to improve the standing of Defense Department police officers for quite some time, most recently with H.R. 324, sponsored by Congressman Filner from California. Tell us about the issue, Brian.
Basically, what this issue is DOD police officers right now were classified as a 0083 series police officer, just like all other federal police officers. So like the Capitol Police, the Park Police, FBI, Pentagon Course Protection, we're all 0083 police officers. DOD police officers, however, we're not equal to the other police officers. They don't allow us to have what is called statutory powers of arrest. H.R. 324 is going to change that and give us the statutory powers of arrest, and basically that's going to give us the ability to do the job that we were hired to do on military bases throughout the United States.
If you are all 0083, why don't you all have the same abilities to make arrests and carry firearms and things like that?
An issue we can't figure out either. Being that OPM under U.S. code is the ones that makes the series on what they are. Why we're not equal across the board, it's unknown to us, but it is something we're working very diligently to try to fix.
Do you have similar job responsibilities as the other officers?
We do the exact same as the other officers. However, we do a lot more as far as protection goes. With all the other agencies, the closest we would be to would be Capitol Police and Pentagon Force Protection. And Pentagon Force Protection and even the VA police, because we're protecting the exact same people that they're protecting. Except for, however, we actually protect our congressmen as well. Even the President of the United States.
Share with us some real on-the-job issues here that come up when you don't have these same authorities.
Here's what one of our biggest issues is right now there's a waste of taxpayer dollars going on with the DOD police. Because we don't have the authority to make an arrest per statute out of the United States Code, we actually have to call an outside agency. So, like, for me, I have to call Prince George's County to come in and take the person that we've detained. And they would actually be the ones making the arrest. So not are we using the DOD police, we're also using now an outside agency. So we're tying up two different budgets to do one agency's job.
Brian, that sounds a little bit redundant, doesn't it?
It's very redundant. Across the United States right now, what happens is with the DOD police, because we don't have statutory powers of arrest, we actually have to call an outside agency to come and take someone that we have detained for a crime and make that arrest for us. So now we're tying up two different budgets. So a lot of times it's going to be local budgets with the state and even municipal organizations and also the DOD.
So how would having the authority to execute warrants, make arrests, and carry firearms help you do your job better?
Basically, it's going to whittle it down to one agency. We're going to be able to do the whole function of a police organization. So it's going to make each individual DOD base, it's going to make it its own law enforcement agency where we would be able to actually make the arrest, do the booking process, and the whole court process as well.
Brian, do you have support of your agency? Does DOD support you on these efforts?
Unfortunately, they do not.
And what about on Capitol Hill? We know, obviously, that Congressman Filner is a champion of this. Who else is with him?
We have approximately seven other co-sponsors of this bill, and I can give you a rundown of those names, too, if you'd like.
Sure.
All right. We have co-sponsoring this bill, we have Congressman Brian Bilbrey out of California. We have Congressman Robert Brady out of Pennsylvania. We have Congressman Gerald Connolly out of Virginia. We have Congressman Jim Gerlich out of Pennsylvania. Congressman Brett Guthrie out of Kentucky. We have Congresswoman Candace Miller out of Michigan, and Congressman Don Young out of Alaska. And this is a very, very bipartisan bill, and the majority right now is Democrat, but it's pretty much 50-50 between Republican and Democratic support.
So you are getting a little bit of support here on Capitol Hill with this. Do you think that the reason that it hasn't gone farther to this point is because people maybe just don't know about it?
That's a lot. It's a lot of us educating our congressmen and congresswomen. I hope that with this, it's not a lot of a political play in this at all, because this really is, it's a bipartisan bill. They both, it's something they both can support.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government on Federal News Radio. We're speaking with Brian Frayer, the Assistant Chief Steward of Local 1401 here at AFGE. Brian, when you talk about educating people, what are you doing to get the message out?
We're doing a lot of mailing to let our representatives know exactly what this bill will do. A lot of people believe that this is going to give us the authority to go outside of our base and take action against the public. Well, in all reality, it's not going to do that. This is just going to give us the ability to do the job of a full-fledged police agency on our DOD military bases.
So the concern is that you might use this in a way that's not in line with your job responsibilities?
Correct. In the past, when it's been in legislation in the past, when Congressman Filner has introduced it, a lot of the things that would be said, like on the internet, if you Google searched it, there would be a national police force issue. Well, that's not what this is going to do. This is basically going to give us the ability to do our job, just like any other law enforcement agency. However, it will also give us the ability to have what they call MOU, a memo of understanding, with other jurisdictions outside of the bases for mutual aid. If we needed help, they'd come and help us. If they needed help, they could call us to come and help them.
Are you working with third-party groups or other unions to get some traction on this?
Actually, we have, and I think all DOD police officers know the FOP has been playing a really big part in police officer rights. They always have. They always will. That's what they do. But we've also been working with the International Brotherhood of Police Officers and also the Teamsters. Cecil Robinson out of Great Lakes in Chicago has really been doing a lot of work out there to organize. He actually went ahead and put together a national information picket that we're going to be doing here coming up July 31st through August 5th.
And if people want to get involved in that, can they get some information from you?
They can. They can email me. It's brianfrayer@gmail.com. And we can get that information to them. Any information they want on 324, if they email me, we can get that information to them.
And it sounds like, Brian, you're making some progress here compared to where the initiative went in the last Congress to now. It seems like it's picking up a little traction, and you're doing some more interacting with the public and working with some third-party groups. Do you see this really taking off at some point?
We're hoping to. I know Congressman Filner is looking at about 100 co-sponsors before he can really, really go and fight for us to get hearings in the House. I've had discussions with Congressman McKeon's office, and he really was not very pro H.R. 324 when I talked to him. He advised me that they would never have hearings on it, and it would probably never be elected or voted on, I'm sorry. But we're hoping to change that. He requested some information to educate him. We got it to him, so we're hoping that we're going to get that changed. But, yeah, the third-party organizations are really starting to be helpful to us. A lot of the DOD officers we're working really close together on this. We're getting a lot of outside letters of support to get this thing pushed through.
Can you describe for the audience what a typical day is like for you as a DOD police officer?
Well, as a DOD police officer, it's just like any other city police officer that you see on the streets. We wear the same uniforms. We're driving the same cars. We do the same jobs. We just do it on a military base.
And what happens if something occurs outside of the military base or close to the military base? Are you able in any way to help if anyone needs assistance?
Unfortunately, we are not. A majority of the bases are in some really, really bad areas. And unfortunately, we are not authorized to go outside of that gate. If there's a traffic light outside your gate and you see something going on where somebody's getting carjacked or mugged or assaulted, we can't act on it. We just sit there and watch. Our hands are tied.
Would H.R. 324 impact that at all, give you a little more a leeway to help the public if services are needed?
It would, because it's gonna authorize us to be able to make those MOUs with those outside agencies to be able to have that mutual aid agreement. If they called us for help or if we seen something going on, we would act as an initial officer where the outside agency, whose jurisdiction it was, would actually come and take that arrest. We would just be a witness to the crime at that point.
And who else are you working with here at AFGE to make sure that this thing takes off and goes to where you want it to go?
With AFGE, we're working with the DEFCON police working group and also the police steering committee with AFGE, along with the legislative team there. And even Mr. Gage has been really helpful to us this year.
Brian Freyer, AFGE Assistant Chief Steward of Local 1401. Brian, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you for letting us get this back on.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about Public Service Recognition Week with Partnership for Public Service Vice President Laura Shane.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Partnership for Public Service Vice President of Communications and Research, Laura Shane. Laura, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
So we have Public Service Recognition Week coming up next week. Give us a preview.
You know, it's a great week. We've got a lot of different and exciting activities planned. But, you know, really what we want is for Americans to reflect on what public servants do for us every day. And, you know, to that end, we've got some cabinet secretaries lined up to talk about what's going on at their agencies and the value that they provide to the American public and how to engage citizens in our government.
And who are some of those secretaries that will be joining you next week?
You know, we're delighted to have Secretary Sebelius, Secretary LaHood, Secretary Donovan from HUD, as well as Administrator Johnson from GSA and Director Barry from the Office of Personnel Management.
And you mentioned that the purpose of the week is to let people know the valuable work that public servants do. Talk a little bit about that and some of that work.
You know, for me, it's incredible. All you need to do is pick up the newspaper, and every day you read about a challenge that our government has to face. And, you know, public servants are on the front lines of all of that, whether it's, you know, dealing with the economic recovery, our nation's energy policy as gas prices soar to, you know, over $4, to security and our global competitiveness, the crisis going on in the Middle East, any major issue that's facing our country right now, it's public servants at all levels of our government that are on the front lines of addressing that. And you know, we think it's really important to remind Americans that there's a set of people out there who dedicate their lives and their careers to the betterment of our country, and all of us benefit.
Public servants can be found, obviously, at all levels of government. We have local, state, and federal. What are some of the jobs that come to mind whenever you think of public servants and the efforts that they provide?
I think the ones that pop immediately to mind that touch us every day are, you know, the teachers, policemen, firefighters, paramedics. You know, those are the folks that, you know, we interact with probably most directly or we rely on at the community level. But, you know, there's a set of folks, you know, that are working behind the scenes, you know, more at the federal government level that are, you know, setting energy policy, that are, you know, really working with other nations to keep our borders secure you know, to make sure goods and services are moving in and out of the country, you know, that affect our way of life in a less tangible way.
Laura, whenever you look at the upcoming events for the week, what do you think stands out the most?
You know, it's what stands out for me is that, you know, it's the variety. So, you know, on Sunday, you know, the Washington Nationals are helping us honor public servants by hosting Public Servant Day. And GEICO is planning a big reception prior to the game for federal employees, you know, to come and you know, get a free hot dog and some soda and you know, just to for them to feel appreciated. And, you know, we're really grateful to GEICO for that. We, you know, we want public servants, particularly in this time where, you know, there's been so much about pay cuts and freezes and, you know, a lot of negativity, to understand and to get the message that they are appreciated and that, you know, we very much value the sacrifice and the dedication that they give us, and we want them to hear messages of thanks.
You brought up the issue of pay freezes and cuts and a lot of the negativity that we hear related to public service. How does that impact the worker, do you think?
You know, as with anyone, I think that would have a demoralizing effect, and particularly as we were brought up to the brink of a shutdown, you know, it's disruptive. It's disruptive to their day. It's disruptive to their work. It's disruptive to their productivity. And, you know, it's no way to manage a government. And if we want the best and the brightest to join our nation's workforce, which, you know, we need, as we were talking about the challenges that our country is addressing, you want the best and the brightest inside government working on those challenges. And, you know, when you demoralize a workforce like that, you not only lose productivity, but, you know, it's a disincentive to service.
Do you think that the upcoming week is almost an opportunity for public servants to push back and say, hey, we are valuable. We do great things for the country.
It is. It does provide, you know, that opportunity. But, you know, more so, what I would like to see is, you know, the nation reflecting on, you know, gee, what does our government do for us? And you know, just to take a moment and reflect on all the things, you know, or how their way of life is impacted at all levels by public servants.
And why do you think it is that we need a very strong, a very professional public workforce to meet the challenges that the country faces ahead?
Because the challenges are just incredibly profound and they're incredibly complex. And, you know, if we want to be competitive in a global economy, if we want to produce, you know, we're a knowledge workforce, and you know, we have to have the best teachers, you know, creating the best students. We have to have you know, policies that promote goods and services being moved throughout the country to promote our economic recovery. I mean, the complexity of our globe, you know, it just requires really, really strong public servants that are dedicated to the American citizen and to delivering goods and values, services to the American people.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government here on Federal News Radio. We're speaking with Laura Shane, Partnership for Public Service Vice President of Communications and Research. Laura, you brought up a great point about the issues that we face ahead, and they are very complex. And I think that raises a good point in the debate between public and private workers. A lot of times in these debates, you hear that public workers aren't capable of doing the job, or they don't do it effectively. But really, the exact opposite is true. These are people who are meeting the most critical challenges that our nation and our globe faces. How do we go about changing that perspective, that look of federal and public workers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jason. It's a big challenge. I mean, certainly there is room for improvement, and there, our government can always do better, and every big institution can always do better. But my experience inside government was that, some of the smartest people I ever met, were working incredibly hard, working long hours, and I think to change the perception and make sure that people know that that's going on, we have to do a better job sharing government success stories. There are tons and tons of success stories, and part of what we do during Public Service Recognition Week is the Service to America Medals, and we will be talking about the 34 finalists for Service to America Medals this year. And you really get a sneak peek at, or just a quick high-level glance at some of the amazing things that are happening in government, whether it's working on, making sure that our broadband policy is up to date so that the nation can be competitive in the technology way and that everybody has fair and free access to technology, or whether it is, working on treaties or, working on major technology innovations, natural disaster response, et cetera. I mean, the list goes on and on. But, we have to do a better job sharing these stories of all the amazing things that are happening. And, that's what I hope happens during Public Service Recognition Week, is that everybody talks a little bit about what they're doing inside government, the value that they provide, their commitment to the citizens, and, the great things that are happening. Because, we get coverage on the failures, and to be sure, there have been shortcomings, and those make the front page of the news, but the successes don't get the same attention. And so, we have to, I think, as a country, do a better job sharing those stories and making sure that the American citizen gets the full and complete picture of their government.
Do you think social media outlets like Facebook and Twitter and some of the others are ways that we can promote the great message of public service?
I think so. I mean, I think we have to share with the American public wherever the American public is. And so if the American public is using social media, by golly, I think we ought to be using social media. And to that end, we did host a video contest for Public Service Recognition Week. We got some cute entries from some public administration students from across government. We got some just compelling looks at how people view their government and how public servants take so seriously their oath of service. So we were out there, trying to use that social media and Twitter and Facebook and Vimeo I think we can, and I think we should.
Could you give an example of one or two cases where there's some really exceptional public service going on?
I could give you 100 really good examples of public service going on if we had the time. I'll go back to last year, after the Haiti earthquake, there was a citizenship and immigration services employee who moved very quickly after the earthquake to help some of the Haitian orphans get reunited with their adoptive families in the U.S. These were kids whose adoptions were pending, and he was able to, fast track their adoptions and get them safely into the country. There were people like Shane Shane Kelly and Eva Risto, who are working out in most of the poorest regions of our country to make sure that people have access to their Social Security benefits. There are people, inside DOD who are working to create state-of-the-art medical evacuation equipment to help our soldiers in Iran or Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, and just, you know, folks that are working on our renewable energy policy and building green and making sure that the government is a leader in green technology for the rest of the country to adopt.
If people want to get involved in Public Service Recognition Week, what can they do?
You know, there's a lot going on throughout the country, so I would encourage them to visit Public Service Recognition Week. And, you know, really, my biggest hope is that, you know, that citizens across the country will just take 5 minutes and say, hey, it's Public Service Recognition Week, and shoot a quick note to the public servants that they know to thank them for their service to our country.
And do you have a website set up where people could go to get some more information on that?
Absolutely. PublicServiceRecognitionWeek.org or a quicker version, PSRW.org.
Laura Shane, Vice President of Communications and Research for the Partnership for Public Service. Laura, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll learn about the effectiveness of protective equipment for federal correctional officers with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jason.
The Government Accountability Office released a report on whether protective equipment would enhance correctional officer safety in the Bureau of Prisons. What did the study find?
Well, the study found a number of factors here, Jason. First of all, the report was actually done to evaluate the impact of protective equipment that could enhance officer safety. In this report, GAO found several factors here. Number one, that the BOP, Bureau of Prisons, has not evaluated the effectiveness of the equipment it provides to ensure an officer's safety, and that correctional equipment experts report that the Bureau of Prisons needs to consider a variety of factors in the acquisition and decisions they make to provide additional equipment. Now, currently, Bureau of Prisons officers are unarmed when they're working inside of these prisons. The only protective equipment that they actually carry on them is actually a radio with a body alarm feature on it in case the officer needs assistance or there's a situation, disturbance, assault on staff or on inmates.
And you mentioned that the Bureau of Prisons hasn't evaluated some of these protective measures yet. Is that right?
Well, they have not evaluated the effectiveness of any additional equipment. In this report, it was also found that the Bureau of Prisons and along with the union and the staff believe that communication is probably the most essential skill that a correctional professional actually can use in most situations. And we agree with that factor. However, the Bureau of Prisons believes if they were to issue things in open compound settings, such as pepper spray to staff members, that staff would less likely use their skills to communicate with inmates in these situations and rely more heavily upon the equipment.
Do you agree with that assessment?
I do not agree with that assessment. We are a very well trained organization. Our staff members actually are very professional and conduct themselves in a professional manner. However, since 2000 to 2010, this study also says that the inmate population has actually grown 50% in that time frame, which we haven't brought that many prisons online in order to safely run and operate our prisons. Overcrowding in our prisons creates undue tension and stress on the inmates, and it also harms or hurts our abilities to safely manage and supervise these inmates as well. So with that factor alone, it has increased the violence that has continued to escalate year to year to year. And some violent acts have actually become more serious, where staff have been injured, and even in some instances, some of our staff members were murdered. And the last was being Jose Rivera on June 20th, 2008 at Atwater.
Brian, that the Bureau relies heavily on the communication skills of its correctional officers, yet the populations in the prisons are rising, inmates are more aggressive, staffing levels appear to be down on correctional officers. At some point, does communication skills become outweighed by other factors mentioned before, such as overcrowding and a more aggressive inmate population?
Well, the Bureau of Prisons, in the union's opinion, has a vicarious liability to ensure safe and orderly operations of its facilities, to protect its staff who work in the prisons, and also at the same time to ensure that we look out for the best interests of the inmates and to protect them as well. Since violence has escalated and serious incidents have continued be a large factor of what's currently happening in the prison system, we believe additional equipment is necessary, because a lot of incidents that do occur in our prisons actually happen instantaneously, the heat of the moment. There are no warning signs. There are preventive measures, such as if a disturbance kicks off in the institution, a rioting-type situation, to where we do have the necessary equipment to go respond and quell that disturbance. But in many cases, the assaults that are occurring are like instantaneous events, and officers have nothing other than that body alarm radio, or to try to defend that inmate with their hands and no other equipment to try to detain them until other responders come in and assist those individual staff members.
So this really becomes a safety issue, right, Brian?
It is a safety issue, Jason. And, you know, at the end of this report, and it's like a 70-page report, and it's fairly lengthy, and there are a lot of graphs and charts in here that talk about overcrowding, that talk about understaffing, that the ratio since 2000 to 2010, since our population has grown by 50%, there are now less staff to manage and supervise these institutions than there were 11 years ago.
So let's talk about some specifics for a second. If an officer is in a dangerous situation, and right now he or she is only armed with a radio and a body alarm, how would something like pepper spray or additional protective equipment really neutralize the situation and give the correctional officer an opportunity to fight back, just in terms of protection, until further help arrives?
Well, the additional equipment is one of those preventative measures that we believe that actually would work in most situations that we encounter. Now, there may be some situations to where, you know, that the equipment, the additional equipment that they provide the staff, or something such as pepper spray or batons or even tasers in some sense, if they were issued to staff, in all cases might not work in that situation. However, we believe when an inmate decides to attack a staff member with or without a weapon, that staff have to have the ability to be able to fend that inmate off, hit their body alarm, to alert staff, to respond to that area. And until additional staff get there, it could be more than one inmate attacking a staff member, that at least that staff member has some defense mechanism to prevent serious bodily injury or even death to themselves. And in other situations, to where there are inmates assaulting other inmates with weapons, that staff would have the ability then to try to contain the situation instantaneously until other staff staff arrive. And that is the importance of trying to get additional equipment such as prepper spray issued to staff so that they have the ability to instantaneously respond to try to prevent these things and serious injury.
Brian, you mentioned before the tragic death of Jose Rivera, who is a correctional officer at the USP in Atwater. How would additional protective equipment maybe impacted the outcome of that situation?
Well, in the situation that involved the death of Jose Rivera, there were cameras in the unit, and there is videotape that actually shows it was a two-tier unit, which means there was two levels, and Jose Rivera actually happened to be on the top level, and the cameras actually identify the fact that when two inmates began attacking Officer Rivera, he was able to break away from them and get to the stairwell to go down. He separated himself. The inmates continued to pursue him, caught up with him on the stairwell. He was able to separate himself again and get on the ground floor before they tackled and brutally stabbed and murdered Officer Rivera. The thing is we believe if Officer Rivera would have had the ability to have some pepper spray that he could have carried, he would have been able then, when he separated himself, to be able to use that and to give him an opportunity to at least stun the inmates. He had activated his body alarm radio at that time, but it took responding staff a couple of minutes to get over to the area, get the doors unlocked, and come inside and to try to restrain those inmates. And we believe there was enough time for Officer Rivera during the times he had separated himself to at least have that piece of equipment to give him the ability to prevent the incident which occurred that led to his death.
And Brian, so that we're clear and the audience understands, you're advocating for non-lethal munitions for correctional officers, such as pepper spray, batons, maybe a taser, nothing like loaded weapons or anything like that, correct?
Absolutely not any loaded weapons. Less lethal equipment, such as pepper spray, which is more or less the preference. And if you look at this study as well, 9 out of the 14 largest state systems around the country actually authorize their staff to carry pepper spray. And this stuff, being less lethal, has no long-term effects on anybody it's used against. It's just a short-term effect to be able to stun and detain that inmate from resisting for several minutes, and that would give us the ability, once a staff does call for assistance and hit their body alarm radio, that in that time may prevent further aggression from the individual.
Brian, in the report, GAO compared federal correctional officers to state correctional officers. Can you share some of the details in the report and the comparisons between the two?
Well, the comparisons between the two, state and federal, we operate different types of systems between all of them. And I would say the variance, even on the state corrections outfits, there are rules and regulation differences in some of these incidents. However, with most of these, and you got to go by security levels of institutions. We have various security levels in our prisons. But in most of these instances, the additional equipment given, in some instances, the staff may carry pepper spray, and some they may carry batons on them. In some, where they may not carry pepper spray or batons or tasers or anything like that, then they have used things such as having two officers together at all times, two or more, so that staff can protect themselves and have somebody there to respond should a situation occur. Now, in many instances, although there may be, 300, 350 staff members that work at any given institution in the Bureau, and all staff are considered when the ratios are actually calculated, in many instances, our staff work these housing units somewhere between 150 and, in some cases, at some low security level prisons, up to 350 inmates by themselves, with no additional staff member assigned to them, and that's who they're supervising. Now, there may be many staff, especially during hours of day watch, somewhere between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., you may have anywhere in the middle of that 250 staff on duty. However, that officer in that unit is still by himself, for the most part, supervising those inmates in those units. And the numbers even drop further of how many staff are actually available to respond or be there after the hours of 4 o'clock, and then you have a very reduced staff from midnight to about 6 a.m. before staff come back in that morning, starting to report.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll continue with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry about the issues facing the Bureau of Prisons.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're joined by Brian Lowry, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Brian, previously we were talking about the GAO report on the enhancement of officer safety if they were given some protective equipment. Based on the GAO's assessment of the situation, what do you expect to see next from the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, as I stated early on, the Bureau of Prisons, in the report, the GAO found that they have not evaluated the effectiveness of equipment it provides to ensuring officer safety. And with that said, they have not done any additional studies or surveys. Now, since Jose Rivera was murdered in June of 2008, the union has actually pursued and actually participated in labor management relations meetings and tried to get the agency to consider alternatives and to consider additional equipment such as pepper spray issue and to bring it in slowly to start at high security level prisons as well as administrative detention centers where you have inmates doing more time and have committed more violent crimes in which they're incarcerated. And the recommendation from the GAO to the Bureau of Prisons was actually for the Bureau to start capitalizing on some of the data that it already collects and to work with and institute some expertise from the National Institute of Justice and the National Institute of Corrections. And the Bureau of Prisons actually responded to this report on April 5th, 2011, and the Bureau actually stated that they concur with the recommendations from the GAO and with the assistance of NIJ, which is National Institute of Justice, and NIC, the National Institute of Corrections, that they will start conducting a study to evaluate the impact of protective equipment on officer safety. Now, at the end of this, on their response, I believe this is just a fluff response. Although they do collect data on assaults and overcrowding and the number of inmates and on understaffing needs in the prisons, I believe that was a way for them just to say, okay, we'll look at these things, but that they don't intend on trying to start this evaluation in any sense. As a matter of fact, we're getting ready to put in a request to the agency to find out, based on their response to GAO, as to when they're going to start evaluating, and ask that they be transparent when they do this, in order to see what the outcome of their report is, which actually has no closure date. So I don't think that they're putting emphasis on starting this, in my opinion.
Will you be trying to push them in that direction, to make some changes on this?
I absolutely will, and the union will be first and forefront on this issue. And, you know, just this year, back in January of 2011, there was a correctional officer that was actually murdered that worked for the Washington State Reformatory Unit in Monroe, Washington. And there was actually a federal investigation that was done in conjunction with the National Institute of Corrections that actually called on Washington State to review their safety needs and improve their equipment that they actually issued to staff. And they called on officers to have the ability to wear personal body alarms there, which we already carry those, and to issue them pepper spray carry to improve their safety. And the second part of that, which the National Institute of Corrections is involved, and GAO has recommended to the Bureau. The Bureau actually agreed to work with the National Institute of Corrections. So I hope that if they do use the National Institute of Corrections, it is going to approve and recommend our ability to carry this equipment, which we believe is vital to our safety and safety of inmates.
Brian, as you know, there are some intense budget battles here in Washington. How do those budget battles affect the staffing and ultimately the funding levels in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, Jason, the Bureau of Prisons actually brings in about anywhere from 5,000 to about 7,500 new bed inmate assignments each fiscal year. And with that, with the budget, the reduction in the budgets that the Bureau of Prisons has seen, it has eliminated our ability to construct new prisons to alleviate the overcrowding in some of these situations that we're currently facing. You know, we have to reach out. We have reached out to our legislators, to Congress, to the Attorney General's office, and asked for them to evaluate and to press the need for additional institutions to lower our ability to provide secure and safe supervision of the inmate population. If we don't construct prisons, then we're going to continue to take these inmates' assignments away. Prosecutions of people violating the law have actually increased year to year to year, and the money that has been pumped into the U.S. Attorney's Office for these prosecutions has increased year to year to year. Prosecutions at the highest level, and then you have inmates put in the pipeline to come into our prison system. Now, we're not going to turn any inmates away that are convicted of a crime and have to be housed. But what it forces us to do is to start putting inmates in areas in our prisons that weren't designed to house these inmates, such as common areas, TV rooms, and then start triple bunking inmates where they're assigned cells designed to safely house two inmates in a cell. We are now putting three inmates in a cell.
Brian, I'm curious to know what your status was when we were looking at a potential government shutdown. Were your employees deemed essential?
The majority of our employees were deemed essential. Any employee that worked at an institution that housed inmates, they were going to continue working, and we were going to operate our prisons as normal.
So that leads to a larger question. If most of your employees are deemed essential, why is it that year after year you're struggling to get the funding that you need to safely operate the prison system?
You know, that's a million-dollar question, Jason. We, as I stated to you earlier, we have lobbied Congress, we have lobbied the Senate, we have talked to these people, we've talked about our overcrowding, we've talked about the understaffing, the effects that it's having on safety, security. We believe assaults are up based on just overcrowding alone, because, as I said earlier as well, It increases tension and stress on these inmates. You know, each housing unit where an inmate is assigned right now only has so many showers, bathroom facilities, TVs available. And as you increase that with the gang activity that we do have and the inmates who are affiliated with gangs and the things that are already going on, it just creates and creates an explosive situation to where sooner or later more serious things are going to continue to escalate and violence will continue to climb. And the worst part of it is we're sending staff in there who are unarmed, who have no ability other than to try to fight inmates off without any additional safety equipment that puts their lives in danger and also puts the inmates' lives in danger.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry about the issues inside the Bureau of Prisons. Brian, what's going on with the assault rates now in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, Jason, each year assaults have escalated. In this report, it is actually noted that each year assaults have actually increased probably by a number of 100, 150 each year over the last 5 or 6 years. The type of violence that has occurred has escalated. Inmates are younger. They're more gang-oriented or affiliated with gang populations inside of prisons. These inmates manufacture and create weapons out of about any type of material, whether it be plexiglass, wood, any kind of metal that they can get from different areas of the prisons, beds. They're able to cut the metal and then design it. Most inmates manufacture these weapons because our prisons are overcrowded and the tensions are so high. Number one, it's to try to protect themselves since there's less staff supervising these inmates. And then two, when situations do occur where the tension is high, disturbance occurs, or an inmate decides to assault a staff member, in many instances, if they have access to these weapons, then they turn around and use them either on inmates or on our staff.
Brian, the GAO report indicated that about half of the inmate population in the Bureau of Prisons is there because of some sort of drug-related offense. Do you find that there's any correlation between those offenses and the violence that's going on inside the prisons?
I wouldn't actually assess that as maybe 50% of our population is in there for drugs, because in many instances, inmates who receive a higher sentence sometime had other charges either they were convicted for or were pending and they weren't charged with in the end that may have involved guns or some type of violence. Based on each prison and how we calculate the security levels at each prison, then you have more predatory, more violent at the higher security levels.
Are certain facilities more susceptible to violence than others?
I would say your higher security institutions and the ones who actually house more violent type inmates who have been convicted of more gun-related or violent crimes such as murder, rape, and those sort of things are probably you have more predatory type inmates, so your violence is going to be a little bit higher in those. And those would be United States penitentiaries, which are high security level, and administrative facilities such as metropolitan correctional centers and metropolitan detention centers and federal detention centers.
Do you think there's something that can be done to lower the violence? Is there something that correctional officers can do to keep themselves safer, or is this just the way it is in the Bureau of Prisons?
Well, I think one step that is necessary is that you have to reduce the overcrowding of the population, which would lower the tension and the stress, I believe, and safely house these inmates, and then you would have an adequate amount of staff to be able to supervise. Now, being so overcrowded, adding additional inmates in there, you have more inmates that you have to try to supervise, maintain, and more areas to cover where we're housing inmates.
Brian Lowry, president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. As always, Brian, thank you for your time. Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE Local 1401 Assistant Chief Steward Brian Frayer, Partnership for Public Service Vice President Laura Shane, and AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Brian Lowry. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and